This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. This show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. America is wrestling today with the legacy of two protracted wars in the Middle East. Part of that legacy is the record number of soldiers returning from the war zones with post-traumatic stress disorder. But of course, these haven't been the first wars from which veterans have come home traumatized and anguished. The late Dr. John Meneely Jr., a Yale Medical School graduate, was one of those who struggled to rebuild his life after returning home from World War II. His daughters have created an oratorio to commemorate their father, and the making of that oratorio is the subject of a new documentary called Letter from Italy 1944, A New American Oratorio, narrated by Meryl Streep. The film premieres this Thursday, June 18th at 8 p.m. on CPTV and was directed by our guest, five-time Emmy Award-winning independent filmmaker Carol Evans of Carol Evans Productions. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So we often associate the beginning of PTSD with the Vietnam War, but your documentary points out through an intimate story told by family members that PTSD was also a struggle for World War II veterans as well.
That's right. We talked to three World War II veterans who are in their 90s during the course of the documentary and learned firsthand about their experience. But the documentary itself focuses around Dr. John K. Meneely Jr. and his experiences in both theaters, the Pacific Theater and in Italy. And he comes back with post-traumatic stress disorder, and his daughters really don't know what's going on. So 50 years later, they are trying to figure that out once they receive his papers. And through the making of this oratorio, they discover what had happened to him.
Tell us a little bit about the daughters and why they chose to tell their story through an oratorio, and maybe also explain what an oratorio is.
Yes. So an oratorio is really a sung prayer, and this particular piece is secular, so it is not religious, but the entire piece is sung. And also unusual for this oratorio, why some people are calling it an opera, is it is staged. So there are costumes, there's staging, there's an 80-piece choir that's on stage, but the five soloists move around the stage. So it's a very interesting kind of combination of both an oratorio and an opera. What's really interesting is that John Meneely's two daughters, one is a published poet, Nancy Meneely, who has a book out, Letter from Italy, 1944, a beautiful poem, and she's been published many times. Both sisters are in their 70s. And then his other daughter, Sarah McNeely Kiter, happens to be a Grammy-nominated composer out of Wesleyan. So it was just the confluence of these two daughters who have these talents. They receive their father's letters, and they come up with this idea to create this oratorio. Now, I will say it was when Joseph DiEugenio from the GM Chorale in Middletown commissioned the work and helped bring the oratorio into a two-hour concert that it really came together.
The documentary is narrated by Meryl Streep, and we have a clip from the film. Let's listen to that, and then we'll talk about Meryl Streep's involvement.
Every generation is affected by war and its aftermath. Letter from Italy, 1944, is a new American oratorio based on a story conceived by two sisters, Sarah Meneely Kiter and Nancy Fitzhugh Meneely, about their father, Dr. John K. Meneely Jr., a medic who served in the 10th Mountain Division during World War II. On April 28, 2013, the Greater Middletown Chorale, led by artistic director and conductor Joseph DiEugenio, presented Letter from Italy 1944 to the public for the first time.
She has a lovely voice.
Oh, so beautiful.
If I didn't know that it was Meryl Streep, I'm not sure that I would have recognized her voice. It's really interesting. There's just a different, I don't know, if intonation or I'm not quite sure what it is, but it is so beautiful. How did Meryl Streep come to be involved in this film?
Well, it's very interesting. The composer, Sarah Meneely Kiter, went to school with Meryl Streep at the Yale Drama School, and within 6 days we had our answer, which was a yes, and she would come to New Haven, and we had 2 hours with her. She came in a blinding blizzard from New York City, drove herself, no driver, no assistant, didn't want any particular food or water, which when you work with a lot of celebrities, you know, there's often a lot of requests. It parked herself, came in the door. It was unbelievable. And, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been directing and producing for 30 years. And to work with Meryl Streep, who I've admired my entire professional life, was an absolute dream for me.
I think it would be for anybody. I'm talking with Carol Evans, a 5-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, about her latest documentary called Letter from Italy, 1944, A New American Oratorio. It premieres on CPTV this Thursday, June 18th at 8 p.m. You also talk with a few other World War II veterans, as you mentioned, and some of their family members. What was that like? Because a lot of them just didn't talk about their experience in the war.
Right. I think at this point, when they're in their 90s, they know that this is, you know, a legacy to talk about this on camera. And the other thing, the focus was really on one of their fellow soldiers. So I think that they were more willing to talk about the experience so that we could understand better what our Yale-trained medic, John Manili, went through. So, you know, we'd have a better sense of really the horrors of what he saw when they were fighting in Italy.
Let's listen to one more clip from the film. And Carol, feel free to set this up for us. This is a part about PTSD and includes a small part of a song from the oratorio.
What really attracted me to this entire project was the first thing I heard, which was the music. The music of this oratorio is unbelievably beautiful. And it's so well crafted, from being very melodic at the beginning and everything is lovely, to as war progresses, things get more atonal. But at the end, which is what you're going to hear a little clip from, you know, when the daughters realize what their father wanted to give them and how hard he tried to give them everything he could, it goes back to this beautiful melodic piece. So I wanted to be sure to include that here so you could hear a little bit of the music.
Let's listen.
The Letter from Italy, 1944 title, although it might have a certain greatest generation quality, is really about the universal soldier and family experience. Music and artistry reach out to soldiers and families.
I've come to really love this character. And if this story touches one person, it's done its work.
The best a wounded man would not could be for those he left behind.
The best a wounded man could be.
You're listening to Sherry Hammerstrom in the female part and Jack Anthony Pott singing the role of the father. And it's just, the music is stunning.
You had said in our communication before today that that particular piece of music that we just heard was your favorite. Why, out of all the music in this oratorio, do you think that particular piece speaks to you?
Well, I also lost my father when I was young, when I was 16. And there's something about the daughter and the father at the end coming together that just really touched me. So I don't think you have to be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or, you know, you have to have lost your father at a young age. It is so beautiful the way you just see two people coming back together who have lost each other, that I think would touch anybody.
As you were putting this film together, what did you find most interesting about Dr. Manili's struggle?
I think that Dr. Manili's struggle is so symbolic of how soldiers struggle when they come back, and how in the past it hasn't been, for whatever reason, available for them to really talk about it with their families, with their children. And so I just thought this was so beautiful because it was really in the making of the film that the daughters really came to terms with the fact that, you know, he does commit suicide. He's in that much pain. And so I just thought it was so interesting that here we have a story that encapsulates so many soldiers' stories and the love that really the families feel towards them, and they just want to love them. They want to know their stories. And I just hope that, you know, with people seeing the story, it will help conversations unfold about the importance of families helping and also the power of art to actually heal. The daughters were healed in large part after the making of this oratorio because they went through this cathartic process. And I think it does. I've seen veterans and people with post-traumatic stress disorder watch this film, and they are so ready to talk after they see this film because it really makes you believe that people really do care about each individual who's suffering.
You mentioned the letters that the daughters had received. How did they know what their father was going through and how much he suffered? Were the letters that detailed?
The letters home from John to his wife Delia were very poignant, and they did talk about the anguish. I think the daughters, though, really knew about how bad it was because of what happened when he got home. When he got home, he continued to try to be a practicing physician for 18 years. But he left for long periods of time when he was institutionalized. He sobbed many times because he couldn't figure out what was going on or he couldn't deal with it. And they saw for themselves his suffering. He was a completely different person from when he left to when he got home. So they knew personally that he had really suffered. And then to be in your teens and your father commit suicide, I mean, they're completely aware of how much he must have been suffering.
This is Carol Evans, a five-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. We're talking about her latest documentary called Letter from Italy, 1944, A New American Oratorio. It premieres on CPTV this Thursday, June 18th at 8 p.m. Carol, talk about the process of doing this documentary. There's so much footage from not only the rehearsals, but the actual oratorio itself and afterwards. How long were you involved in this process?
I think overall it was about 2 years. We were lucky enough to be funded by the Connecticut Office of the Arts, so there was a budget. We filmed probably 10 different rehearsals and various different, you know, things that happened in the community. There was a whole community component. And then for the actual performance, we had a two-camera shoot for that particular performance. It's only been performed one time. All this effort went into this, and it was performed one time. And then I had 5 professional shoot days in addition to get the interviews that I needed from all the creators. Because in addition to the two sisters and Joe DiEugenio, there was also Sheila Garvey, who was the resident director at the time, and she staged the oratorio. There were the 6 soloists. There were the 80 choir members. There were the people in the community. There were the vets, and there was a 30-piece orchestra. There was a lot to cover, so I did have a lot of footage.
What do you look for when you are considering putting together a documentary?
Well, I'm in the position where after 30 years of doing this, it's very nice that people come to me with projects that are funded. And if it was something I absolutely did not want to do, I wouldn't. But generally, I have a real intellectual curiosity about a lot of things. I really like to learn. And so I love the beginning of the process when I start to figure out the story, because often in this case, the story was supposed to be the making of the oratorio. But as the process grew and I got to know the sisters and I started understanding, when you start getting to know people, the real story starts to get revealed, which is what I love about documentary filmmaking, because it's not that straightforward. You have to really try to figure out what is the story. So by the end, I realized that the story really was about post-traumatic stress disorder and how it affects the family, the wife, and the daughters. And although the making of the oratorio is lovely and the music is exceptional, it really comes down to being about a family who went through these incredible struggles and the power of this oratorio and the making of it to help heal this family.
What do you hope happens from this film?
Well, luckily, the Connecticut Office of the Arts has funded now the making of the concert video. So I'm in the process of editing the concert video together. There's also been interest from the Bushnell and perhaps Yale to do productions of this. I see this at the Kennedy Center eventually after, you know, we have some productions here. It is that exceptional, and the story is that universal.
You showed the film to a focus group at Yale that consisted of veterans and people who suffer from PTSD. What was their reaction?
I couldn't believe the way it just opened people up to talking about their very personal stories, both in front of the audience that was assembled, and also a couple came to me holding hands, both crying, saying, "That was our story. You just told our story."
The film is called Letter from Italy, 1944, a new American oratorio directed by Carol Evans. It premieres this Thursday, June 18th at 8 p.m. on CPTV. Carol, thank you for coming in and congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, an executive from the Second City Comedy Theater explains how improvisation can have a positive effect on our business and personal relationships. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. We'll be back after this break. This is the Faith Middleton Show. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith. For more than 50 years, the Second City Theater Group in Chicago has launched the careers of many brilliant comedians like John Belushi, Tina Fey, Stephen Colbert. The list is staggering and it goes on. But the Second City has also been using their comedy and improvisational training to help corporations and individuals, most of whom will never step foot on a stage as an actor, to become more innovative, creative, and confident. My guest has seen the transformations firsthand. He is Tom Yorton, CEO of Second City Works. He's co-written this book with Kelly Leonard, who is Executive Vice President of the Second City. It's called Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. Tom, welcome to the show. I thought we could start off by explaining what the yes and rule is in improvisation.
Absolutely. Well, it's great to be on, and thanks for having me. Yes and is really the building block, kind of the foundational tenet of improvisation. And when you think about how improvisers work, they're on stage in front of an audience that expects them to be interesting, and there's no script to guide the action. So they have to have some way of communicating and working together to create interesting and funny material. And yes and is basically that building block. And really what it is there's a couple actors in a scene, it's or in an ensemble. No matter what one actor offers, it's the job of the ensemble mates to affirm or to agree with that and to add something to it. Basically creating something out of nothing in the moment by just building one brick at a time to get to a great place. And that's how we create sketches, that's how we create characters, that's how we create entire shows, and I'd argue that's how we built the company over 56 years.
How has this way of thinking and training helped corporations? Can you tell one of the stories in the book that illustrates what you mean?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's so many different ways it works. And first, I'll answer broadly and then talk about a specific example. But, you know, broadly, this kind of thinking is very useful in the business world, but somewhat counterintuitive. Business world is really kind of governed by critical thinking and kind of figuring out what's missing or what's wrong or what's incomplete. And while there's absolutely room for that, it's essential. You have to scrutinize and you have to kind of unpack things in business too to get to where you want to go. There's precious little of this affirming and building on ideas. It may be reserved for the first 15 minutes of a brainstorm, but it doesn't color the days of most people in the work world. I remember a story we were working with an HR manager who was selected as a high-potential person within a big tech company, and she was having the hardest time She was super talented, but somewhat introverted, somewhat shy, and having a hard time connecting with people in these different job rotations that she'd be on as part of the high potential program. And she didn't know how to initiate a conversation and build on a conversation so that she could establish rapport and feel comfortable in new situations. We worked with the entire group, but she in particular benefited from it because it gave her yes and some of these listening skills exercises that we talk about and some of these ideas that are core to improvisation really helped her kind of break down her own barriers to communicating with other people and just be more comfortable in her own voice. People get so hung up in their own interpersonal communication in terms of what they're saying and what they're offering. And improv's kind of interesting in that it is really the other way around. It's kind of other-directed. And so if you're the kind of person who can listen and build on the ideas of others, there's less of a burden for you to feel like you always have to initiate something and always have to be the person with the golden words at just the perfect time. So it was a little bit liberating for her, and it gave her a completely new way to think about herself as a communicator.
Yeah, I can see how that would be beneficial, maybe even in journalism. Some people seem to be born with the ability to naturally improvise, and for the rest of us, it looks so difficult. Can you learn to improvise, and can you become good at it?
Yeah, without a doubt, it is a very trainable skill. And, you know, we have a burgeoning training center. The corporate work that we do, in many ways, emanated out of the work that we did as an actor school. We're the largest actor school in the world between our Chicago, Toronto, and Hollywood locations. We're training well over 10,000 aspiring actors a year and really showing how they can use these things for the stage. But along the way, we've learned that these same skills, the so-called soft skills that you need to be successful in business, those soft skills map very nicely back to improvisation. It's the same things like how to listen, how to read a room, how to build trust on teams, how to create and innovate on the fly, how to be resilient in the face of failure. All of those things our people are taught how to do from a performance standpoint, but I'd argue, having spent 17, 18 years in big companies, that those are essential skills for leaders in business.
Tom, why did you want to write this book?
We wanted to write this book because we were tired of other people writing about it and we were actually doing it. It felt like we got to kind of codify this stuff and put it down. You know, I've been now with the company almost 14 years. Kelly's been with the company 26 years. And we're doing this all the time. I mean, we've become very prevalent, especially in business. We do over 400 engagements a year and half of them with Fortune 1000 companies. So we're doing the work. A lot of times people write books and then go do the work. We've been doing the work all along but had never put it down on paper. And I guess that's somewhat of an improviser tendency not to put anything down on paper. But we finally committed to saying, let's let people know what's underneath this, that there's a there, that there's a pedagogy underneath these things and there's a method behind the madness. And it's not just a bunch of pie-in-the-face guys running around trying to teach business skills, but there's a real core group of skills that you can learn, and we wanted to talk about that.
This is Tom Yorton. He's CEO of Second City Works and has co-written this book, Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. The Second City, famous, as we've said, for nurturing and training comedic talent, basically used its own training technique to expand its business by saying yes and to individuals like business executives and salespeople. Why did you want to go in that direction?
Some of it was by design and some of it just happy accidents and kind of yes-anding ourselves. And, you know, the corporate business, we've always done work with corporate clients, but in a much more ad hoc way. And only recently, in the last 15 years or so, have we been much more intentional about, hey, what do we have to offer for professionals? But we wanted to do it because we saw the ability to have impact and to make work better, frankly. Our company is called Second City Works, and we named it that way because we were finding ourselves in all these engagements with clients, and invariably we were helping them to do things better on the job, to get more fulfillment and more satisfaction and more productivity in their day-to-day work. So we said, why not? These are very valid methods, and if you want to be a better performer, whether that means on the stage or in your work, we've got something to offer.
What are the qualities of a good improviser?
I would say the foremost quality is other-directedness. I'm going to make it two things. and then I'll probably make it 7 million. you know, things like being others-focused. There's an axiom in our work, always take care of your scene partner. And, you know, we're not a stand-up comedy club. We don't have the lone comic going out trying to win over an audience. We're an ensemble art form. And so when you're creating as an ensemble, you learn to really treasure what your ensemble mates are bringing. And you know that sometimes they're going to bail you out with an idea that unlocks something really funny and interesting. And then sometimes you'll be the one that unlocks something for them. So it's this kind of mutual trust that you learn to get within an ensemble. So this other directedness is really key to improv. And then I would say another factor that is absolutely huge is listening and being an acutely strong listener. You know, I'm not an actor. I didn't come up as an improviser myself. And I think that was one of the big ahas for me when I got to Second City, is just really understanding what fantastic listeners these people are. And to be a successful improviser, you have to learn to listen to understand, not just listen to respond. And that really struck me because I think about, again, my background is the work or professional environment. It just struck me as very different than how people communicate in business, where you're cutting each other off all the time. You're always one-upping or trumping. You're definitely not listening to understand. You're listening basically to maintain control of a conversation. So I thought those were two really essential skills.
And I want to get back to listening. I also wanted to talk about something else that you talk about in the book, which is how companies can benefit from the yes and approach. And I'm thinking here about innovation. If your company's having a brainstorming session about improvements to its product and someone in the group comes up with an idea that's not at all new, or maybe it's already been tried, how you might be able to apply the yes and concept, knowing this idea isn't going to be the winning one, and especially since one of the goals of this approach is to make people feel less intimidated about speaking up and offering suggestions.
Yeah, absolutely. There's some definite ties between improvisation and innovation. And I would say a couple, twofold. It's more the role of humor or irreverence in comedy and satire in the business world. And on the surface, that may not appear obvious at all. But what we talk about is this idea of respecting ideas but not revering ideas. And very often in business, people become so caught up in the status quo, caught up in the way they've always done it, so reverential of bosses and products and company history, and even competition, that they're afraid or unable to see what other possibilities might exist. And you can't innovate in the first place unless you're willing to say, hey, what's possible? What if? What if we did it this way? Or what if there was some new approach we could take? So there's a healthy balance. And for us, often humor helps to kind of tee up what's incomplete or what's not working, and it makes it safe to consider other possibilities. So that's one aspect of it, just kind of creating the conditions where people are willing to see that there's room for improvement in something. The second thing is obviously all these kind of yes and is obviously about building on ideas. And usually the way innovation works is the first ideas, often most of them are poor and not usable. But we like to think of those ideas as, if nothing else, bridges to better ideas instead of blind alleys or problems. And again, when people are brainstorming and not doing this in a trained way or in an intentional way, they often get frustrated that 30 minutes into the brainstorm they don't have that golden idea yet. And you just have to kind of commit to a different way of thinking about it, that you have to value the people who are bringing those ideas, and you have to create conditions where they're willing to kind of come out of their comfort zone to offer them.
This is Tom Yorton. He's an executive at the Second City Comedy Theater in Chicago. He's co-author of this book, Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back for more conversation with Tom Yorton. I'm Lori Mack, in for Faith Middleton. We've been talking with Tom Yorton. He's an executive from the Second City Comedy Theater in Chicago, and he's co-author of this book, Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. He's been explaining how they've managed to help businesses using the same skills that are used in improvisation. Tom, you say in the book that when you're in full improviser mode, we are better leaders. Can you give us an example? What does that look like?
Yeah, in fact, my co-author tells this story all the time. Kelly Leonard talks about when he was writing the book, his writing pattern was to come in the office and kind of work early through maybe mid-morning. And his team learned that it was a really good time to talk to him if you had an idea or a challenge or a problem, to come to him on those days right after he finished writing, because he was in practice. He was actually thinking about these ideas and being much more intentional about how he was leading and how he was working with people. He talks about himself as a prime example, but the leadership examples abound. And I think one of the things that we talk about in terms of leadership is there's another improv axiom or improv idea called follow the follower. You know, it's a common practice to talk about following the leader. In our work, we talk about following the follower. And that notion is that in business, especially these days, it's not so much a top-down pyramid setup where there's a leader who's the omniscient director of all activities. And these days, teams form and they disband, and it's a much more fluid dynamic courtesy of globalization and technology and a bunch of other things. So in improv, when you're watching a scene unfold from a leadership standpoint, it's not like there is a cast leader or an ensemble leader who is dictating where things are going. It's the job of everyone to support and everyone to get behind whoever initiates, and then you're supporting the people who are initiating. So it becomes very almost invisible to the audience how ideas are coming about and who's leading, because everyone's mostly supporting. It's not so much a focus on who's out front.
You talk about fear, and you say fear of failure is the biggest threat to creativity. You've seen this quite a bit, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's prominent everywhere. And it's a natural thing. No one wants to look bad. No one wants to get the idea wrong. No one wants to hurt their organization. No one wants to feel foolish in front of their peers, right? So it's a common thing, and certainly I've exhibited plenty of that in my own career of, you know, kind of gripping it a little too tight and, you know, not making decisions out of fear of failure. But for us, what we try to do is say, while that's natural and while you're going to have that, if you actually want to get beyond some of the box you're in, you have to be willing to entertain new ideas, and you have to be willing to put something out there. And, you know, we don't come in and say, hey, we're going to do a two-hour session, and then you will no longer be afraid of anything. What we say is, at Second City, we do that. We have a very structured way of doing that, and that's in our improv set. You know, when you come to a Second City show on the stage, you see a two-act scripted review, and then you see an improv set, a third set, that follows that. And the improv set is, by definition, unscripted. It's also free. We don't charge people to come see it. They can have a good time. We set a context that makes it okay for us to have this laboratory or this kind of proving ground where we can test out new ideas and play with new things. And there's a context for it. And what we'd argue for in business, if you're afraid of failure, create your own improv set. Find a way to have a pocket of time once a week, once every 2 weeks, it doesn't really matter, where you're going to commit to allowing new ideas to come to the surface, and you're going to support them, and you're going to at least allow them to breathe, you know, before you put them to bed. It's not something you can change overnight in a corporate culture, and it does run counter to the way most organizations work, so you have to find your way to create your own improv set.
And you use a number of exercises during these training sessions. Do you have a favorite exercise?
I do. I mean, one is about listening, and I've spent my whole life in client service, you know, in ad agencies or, you know, when I was in a marketing role in big companies, and listening is so important, and we never practice it. You think about it. People practice presentation. They practice writing. You can take classes on this stuff, but where do you go to practice your listening? It's a really difficult thing to do, yet I would argue few things are more important. So one of the exercises that we do is an exercise called last word response. And we instruct people to pair up. You can have a conversation about anything at all. It doesn't much matter what you're talking about. And the only stipulation is that your response has to start with my last word of my statement. So if I said something like, boy, it's a beautiful day outside this morning, and then the other person would say, morning is my favorite time of day. And then the other person would say, day is a lot brighter than night. And, you know, you'd have a conversation where you would be making these statements, but people would have to be listening. So I like that exercise for a few different reasons. One, it forces people to practice this notion of listening all the way through what someone says. In a typical exercise, they wouldn't say statements as brief as the ones I just used in the example. You'd have more of an elaborate conversation. But again, because it runs so counter to how we work in our personal lives and our professional lives, usually we're tuning out about halfway through whatever someone is saying because we're busy planning our response, either to, you know, redirect the conversation back where we want it to go or to demonstrate that we have some knowledge or whatever. But invariably, a lot is lost when you don't listen all the way through.
And I'd like to add one more to that to make sure there's no dead air. We're also preparing to make sure that doesn't happen, too.
That's funny. In your line of work, that makes sense, and I get that. But in the work world, people are really afraid of dead air. And sometimes silence is really useful and beneficial and helpful. But it is awkward, and we're taught that that is something to be avoided.
I mentioned in our last segment that we get back to listening, which was my favorite section of the book. In that section, you say that self-consciousness smothers our ability to communicate effectively, and one way to distract ourselves from being self-conscious is to keep listening.
Yeah, there's almost a mindfulness aspect of improvisation where people tend to be very self-conscious, right? And as I mentioned earlier, improv is really about being very other-directed and very ensemble-focused, being attuned to what's happening around you. And when your energy is going on, being really hyper-focused on what's happening this very moment, you become much less self-conscious. You know, you're not worried about yourself. You're not worried about the thing that you said wrong, quote-unquote, you know, 3 minutes ago. When you're improvising, you don't have time for what happened before or what happened after. You have to be right there in the moment right now. And I just love that about it. The reason I'm not a good improviser, I'm not a performer, and you wouldn't pay to see me ever on stage. And one of the reasons that I really struggle with it is because I'm an editor. I'm constantly kind of in my own mind tweaking what I'm saying and more of a writer mentality, and that's fine. There's a real role for that, but it's not the best thing if you want to be a fluid, supportive improviser. So if I ever wanted to go down that road, which I do not, but if I ever went down that road, I'd have a lot to do to get rid of that self-consciousness of constantly editing myself.
You're in good company. This is Tom Yorton. He's CEO of Second City Works and has co-written this book, Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. You've mentioned the word ensemble a lot, and you like to use ensemble in place of team.
Yeah, we think it's a good distinction. Again, it's not like we use it exclusively and we never say the word team in our plays. We do, and we respect that in business too. But I guess some of it came out of, you know, we've done so much work in a team development and team building capacity as well that often when we come into those situations, people are jaded and cynical because they've had really bad team building experiences that were anything but team building. They were kind of these forced marches into fun or something, and so often that provokes an eye roll in the business world. So the word team has kind of a loaded connotation often, so that's one reason. There's a couple other distinctions about ensemble that we think are important. One is it implies collaboration versus competition. Team is a word that is usually invoked in a competitive endeavor, and often business obviously is competitive because you're trying to sell your product versus someone else's product, and we understand that. But too often, the competition turns internal, and people start competing with each other within the four walls of the company, and that's counterproductive. As opposed to focusing all their energies on the bad guys outside of the company, they kind of have a circular firing squad. And the other piece is the late, great Sheldon Patinkin, who was a luminary at the Second City for many, many years and just an inspiration to our company, often hit a great phrase about ensembles. You know the phrase, you're only as good as your weakest link? Sheldon had a really interesting adaptation of that. He said, ensembles are only as good as their ability to compensate for their weakest link. There's a couple of really interesting thoughts in that. And one is that at any given moment, any one of us might be the weakest link in any endeavor. You know, I might know the most about a particular topic one day, but I might be in a learner mode another day. And so so this idea that no matter who is the weakest link, it's the job of the rest of us not to exile or ridicule or criticize the person who's not bringing their very best, but it's the job of the ensemble nevertheless to compensate for what that person isn't bringing. And once you start to understand that on any given day, any one of us might be that weakest link, you begin to have a greater appreciation for your ensemble mates and the power of ensemble.
And you talk about also, in regards to ensembles, how important it is to have diversity within ensembles and how that relates to business as well as comedy. Can you talk about that as well?
It's hugely important just because, and again, from a theater standpoint, we want to project a voice that represents the social conditions that we're living in. And so the best way to do that is make sure that those voices are represented in the first place. And we talk quite openly about the fact that at Second City that wasn't always the case. In the very beginning, in terms of gender equality on the stages, and then in terms of other forms of diversity. So in business, that's equally important. In order to generate ideas, in order to be resilient and nimble in the face of changing conditions, you want to have the people on a team that can give you the best chance to succeed, and usually that comes from a diverse group of people because they'll bring new solutions and unlikely ideas into the equation, versus having everyone who sees every problem the same way and offers the same set of solutions every time as well.
We've certainly all heard the words comic relief, and it's easy to understand. Most of us have actually experienced a situation or two where comedy truly provided relief. There's a part in the book where you talk about timing, knowing your audience, and distance. Distance meaning putting some time between comedy and tragic events. I'm wondering, as we hear about the scrutiny facing police forces across the country following incidents like we've heard about in Ferguson and New York, and I don't mean in any way to make light of tragedies like these, but do you think this kind of training could be useful in opening up the dialogue, and will there ever be enough distance to try?
I think so, and I think you have to be really smart about it, and you have to be really judicious about it. You know, on the stage, there's really not too many topics we won't take on, because we're an arts organization, so it's about that, being willing to go there and being willing to say whatever you need to say. And, you know, we've been a place that's been a temple of social political satire for 56 years. So from the stage, there's not too many things we wouldn't take on, and those are the kinds of themes that, for those people who haven't been to a Second City show, that's the kind of thing that you would expect, is material and themes that would take on precisely those kinds of issues. You know, I don't know that that equates to going in and working, say, with police organizations and using humor to tee those things up. But what I would say is, in our experience, we've literally worked with thousands and thousands of corporate clients in my 14 years, literally. And one of the things that we've learned is there's not too many topics that are sacrosanct. I make the case that the thornier the issue, the more difficult the topic, the more inaccessible the topic, the more you need to create a forum where people actually are willing to talk about it and not talk around it. I think, whether it's in a government organization or a corporate situation, I think the greater danger isn't talking about it. I think the greater danger is ignoring it. And when there's malfeasance, or when there's bad behavior, or when there's just poor decision-making and people aren't acknowledging, you know, what's really going on, leadership creates a chasm between themselves and the rank and file, where the rank and file knows what's really going on. You know, they're living it. So to pretend that those things aren't happening and to pretend that it's all going okay creates a greater problem, because people disengage. There's a cynicism that comes around, and they just check out and they go, well, people aren't going to be straight about this topic, so it doesn't make sense for me to fully engage. So what I would say is there's not too many topics that you can't take on if you do it respectfully. And one of the things about with comedy that we talk about is we never like to punch down. You know, we never want to be someone who, if you're in a high-status situation, use comedy to ridicule someone in a lower-status situation. That's just kind of being a bully. Mm-hmm. What we'd rather do is say, what are the conventions? What are the prevailing thoughts and attitudes? And what's incomplete or ripe for satire about how society is viewing this issue overall? And then you take on those norms and conventions, and it seems like that's more fertile ground for us and more productive for everybody.
Can you talk a little more about being in the here and now, which I know is crucial to improv, but it also sounds so exhausting.
Yeah, it's funny. It is. I think, boy, the focus you have to do this, you know, when we do these classes, we cap them mostly. There's a few things that we do that will last longer than kind of a half day, but people don't realize at the end of, you know, 2 or 3 hours of doing these kinds of exercises that they need a break because you are engaging your brain in a different way than you do every day on the job. So, yeah, it does require a focus, but you can build that. It's like conditioning for anything. And then once you get good at it, you learn how that can actually cut down on some of the wasted effort and wasted energy that you spend on your job every day.
Can anyone be funny even if by nature they just aren't?
You know, we don't teach people how to be funny. What we teach them to do is to be very supportive of what's going on around them, to be great listeners, and to build on that. And out of that kind of orientation, humor tends to flow, and honesty tends to flow, and things are funny when they're true. So if you're pointing out things that are true, often that leads to the funny. Some people are more or less funny than others, but I think often, from my view, as a guy who I open most of the talks that I do with the qualifier line, I'm probably the least funny guy in the company. But I've come to appreciate this stuff and appreciate what it can do to help people communicate and collaborate. So if you're willing to kind of be other-directed, if you're willing to listen and build on the ideas of others, you have a fighting chance, actually, of being interesting and funny at the same time.
Tom, is there a person you've kept in touch with after a training session at a business whose life has changed dramatically as a result of incorporating improvisational skills?
Yeah, in fact, we've hired a couple of them. It's funny, I started out as a client before I came to work here. This work does transform people. We've hired a couple people who were at one point clients, and they were affected so strongly by the work that they said, I think I've got something to offer. I'd love to work with you guys to help move this all forward. I'm thinking also of a client in a medical industry who was horribly afraid of public speaking. We worked with her and did a lot of individual coaching, again, using a lot of these techniques that we use for the stage, and had such a tremendous breakthrough that she is, in her organization right now, one of the go-tos who goes out and talks and advocates regularly about the work that their company is doing in the medical field. And this is someone who was absolutely transformed by these skills. And most of us are so afraid of public speaking because we're so focused on ourselves instead of focused on what we can actually bring an audience that can be useful.
It seems like another message comes through in this book on a much deeper level, and that is that healing and connection can begin to take place through laughter, under the right circumstances, of course, and it sounds like you might agree with that.
No doubt. When people are laughing, there's a shared recognition of something. It's a unifying thing that we do, and I don't know what the anthropological roots of that are, but I can say that when people are laughing, they're laughing in terms of shared recognition. And often when we go into a corporate environment, we use humor to hold a mirror up to a situation, that we'll talk about the thing that everyone knows needs to be talked about, but they won't do. We'll talk about the merger that's not working so well, that's making everyone crazy. We'll talk about that new compensation policy that everyone is really upset about. And it's not just to use comedy to make fun of that thing. It's using it to create space to have an honest exchange. And then when you do that, when you talk about the stuff that people are talking about at the bar anyway, you kind of defang it, you demystify it, and you make it possible to have an open exchange so you can get beyond the problem. So that's what we're using comedy to do in a business setting. On the stage, you know, it's there for a different reason. It's there for just pure entertainment and for art. But this is absolutely something that is beneficial on a personal or a family level. I use this stuff in how I deal with my teenagers. So it's absolutely something that can benefit you in the work world, but also at the dinner table.
Thank you for this book, and thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The book is called Yes And, How Improvisation Reverses No But Thinking and Improves Creativity and Collaboration. We've been talking with Tom Yorton. He co-wrote the book with Kelly Leonard. I'm Lori Mack, sitting in for Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening.